Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'd like to ask you, have you had God and his wife over to dinner lately? What? You hadn't thought of it that way? That it's a family? Well, let's look at this family or lack of or need to include God's wife. And we're going to look at the whole history of this. And it's a book called, that I recently read, I love it, When God Had a Wife. Well, let's bring this wife back. And we're going to talk about that. It's The Fall and Rise of the Sacred Feminine in the Judeo-Christian Tradition. So we're going to speak with the authors of this book, Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince. Lynn and Clive, welcome to Energy Stew.
Thank you very much for having us on.
Yes, hello, Peter.
Hello, yeah, Peter.
Great to be here.
Well, I'm so excited about this because you're tackling something that is so necessary in today's society and actually has been through our history. But somewhere along the way, God's wife got knocked aside.
Sadly, yes.
But let's talk, a lot of people don't know that God had a wife. And perhaps we need to look at who that wife was and appreciate her history in this long story of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And it even goes through Buddhism too, because Buddha had a wife. And what happened to her? She was abandoned, totally, the day after she gave birth to their son. And what does that say?
Well, so
it's not just Judeo-Christian.
Well, it is through everything. And, you know, you even think of, religions like Hindu, which have very strong goddess figures in. You can't get much stronger than Kali. But they don't treat their women terribly well, in the cultures. So it is. It's not. Although we're writing about the Judeo-Christian tradition because that's the one that we grew up in. It's by no means unique to them, unfortunately.
Right. No,
but we often do say and often think how much better our traditions would be, our culture would be, if the sacred feminine had been allowed to continue over the millennia and had been respected and given her place alongside the male god.
Right. And yet women kept finding their way here and there. Certainly Buddha's wife was supported by a family of women, including Buddha's stepmother, and they developed circles, healing circles, for the wife who was abandoned, who needed healing. And so there's a great growth in the world, even today, especially today, of women's circles.
Yes.
Oh, great.
Yes.
And of course, it's the same thing happening in Christian circles and Jewish circles. But even so, there's we found there's a lack of awareness of the fact that female worshippers in those religions are claiming their place and asking to be treated with respect. But even so, a lot of them don't realise that actually at the start of that tradition, God was not alone.
The thing is that people often say to us, isn't it enough that you have female rabbis and women priests in the Church of England, for example, in the Anglican Church? Isn't that enough? Isn't that enough of progress? And well, I would say no, it's not enough, because basically, in order to understand why we got to this, the need, if you like, to apparently suddenly have these women taking part in religious, officiating religious ceremonies. What happened to the feminine beforehand? We need to know that. We need to acknowledge how we got to this place. And it's not a pretty journey. The number of women, and I include goddesses in that really, the number of females over the millennia who have been maligned quite deliberately, actually, in order to simply get rid of them, in order to erase them.
Well, worse than maligned, they did get rid of them in many cases.
Erased. I mean,
physically.
Virtually erased, but never quite totally erased.
Right.
That's our point.
Well, women have always existed in the life of men because they provide them with family.
Yeah.
And but women needed support. And I'm looking at the history of this, and I'm seeing really how God did have a wife who was worshipped. And in the early days, she was known as Asherah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. Yeah, absolutely.
And God was depicted historically often symbolically with a standing stone, and next to it was a tree.
The tree
was the female
goddess.
And so historically, women, especially women, have needed to worship a goddess.
Well, needed, if you like, an archetype that they could relate to, you know.
Well, that's what I mean, not Virgin Mary.
Oh, no, not the Virgin Mary. No, I mean, sorry, we shouldn't really laugh. No, but I mean, you know, the emergent church, I mean, you know, they realized that the Christians missed having a goddess in their life, missed having the sacred feminine, and were clamoring, you know, because they used to be pagans and all their goddesses had been taken away from them by Christianity, essentially. And so, you know, when the church was first being properly formulated officially and rigorously, it was decided to kind of invent a goddess, but obviously under the men's terms. And so they invented the Virgin Mary. I mean, it's interesting, the first canonical gospel, Mark, you know, did not have the virgin birth in it. You know, I mean, she was, obviously, Jesus must have had a mother, but the fact that they turned her into a goddess was perhaps unfortunate, because it wasn't the kind of goddess that women needed. She wasn't a whole woman. She had impossible standards of purity. You know, she was a virgin mother, for heaven's sake. You know, I mean, that's impossible to start off with. So, you know, she, not terribly relatable.
Right. But looking back and to see the shift from where women were respected and needed in society, as the goddesses were needed in society, and actually many other types of gods and goddesses were important because people had many needs and they needed not just one powerful, vague energy. Mm. They wanted to relate.
Yeah.
And women needed to have someone to relate to that understood them.
Yeah.
Not a male who doesn't represent understanding women.
Yeah, but all that, my point is, you know, talking about the Virgin Mary, I mean, she did not represent all aspects of being a woman.
Right.
You know, very, very narrow and impossible aspect. And, you know, so you're quite right. I mean, people need to find in their deities, plural, right, to something they can relate to.
And Asherah was also a fertility goddess. That really was important.
That goes, you know, that obviously goes with the motherhood aspect. But that also meant she actually had a very kind of raunchy side as well, which was looked at in, you know, all these deities had different names for kind of different modes. So that it's Asherah when she's in the kind of the motherly, eternal, wifely, and in a way matronly role. But then she was also often depicted, say, in this very raunchy,
as a consort,
which was that under the name Kadesh.
Right.
And it's interesting when you start looking into words that are used in the Hebrew Bible, you know, the Old Testament, And you find some of these words that were applied to Asherah sort of hidden away there, and people forgot the meaning over the centuries. And it's really a lot of kind of scholars, you know, academics, biblical scholars are going into the language and now recovering a lot of this. This is one of the things we wanted to do with the book, is to actually show people how much evidence there is for this, you know, apparently bizarre claim, you know, that the God of the Old Testament had a wife. You say that to people and they just think, kind of, you know, what are you on? But we actually wanted to show that, yeah, there's now a lot of evidence not put forward by, you know, kind of New Age types or, people that haven't done the studying, but actual serious, real academics, archaeologists, you know, people that have spent decades researching the language of the Bible, and have found out lots of different pieces of this jigsaw. But we couldn't really find much that had put it all together.
You did.
And so we wanted to put it in one place to show people, actually, you know, there's no argument anymore. You know, in that time, the Old Testament times, those books of the Bible were originally written from the point of view that Yahweh or Jehovah wasn't the only God at all. It's just the one God the Israelites worshipped. Mm. And he had a partner.
And also, while it might be said that Yahweh was respected and feared, Asherah was loved.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm looking at this really from a yin-yang perspective, male-female perspective, that the whole God thing is up, is above us, is from the heavens, and maybe even seeing God as the sun, Ra. But the female energy is the earth. And so what does that represent? That represents life on earth. It represents, you know, the complications of life. And women, because they give birth, it's very complicated. They have their bodies. I just recently did a radio show with a woman who's a Zen Buddhist abbess, head of Zen Center, and she said women have to be treated differently than men because they have needs that men don't have, that can't just, you know, be walk into a Zen Center, just sit for hours, because they have other, you know, feminine needs, and can't be ignored. So there's some life on this planet that is being ignored. And I think that's why our planet isn't respected. It's the Earth Mother.
I think you're right. It's a very, you know, the way we've treated the planet is kind of coming from a very male perspective. It's there to be used and exploited and made a profit out of without thinking too far ahead, you know. Whereas, you know, it's kind of like trying to bring up a child without actually planning ahead as a mother would do, you know. So yes, we certainly need that.
But of course, the thing is that it's not just women in a sort of little bubble. You know, if you mistreat women, you mistreat their children, and that's everybody, you know. Those children are going to come up and be men and women, you know.
I know, it's amazing how ignorant that all is.
Yeah.
I was just also thinking, because you mentioned in the book about Malkut in the Tree of Life is an energy at the bottom of the base of the Tree of Life that's called Kingdom.
Yeah.
But it represents the female. And yet, there's an energy in the groin area called Yesod. So, because I teach this in my classes, and I say, well, women might wonder why they got the floor instead of the body, especially the groin area. Why can't that be respected in women? And because men needed to proclaim their fertility, their potency. Whereas women the reason it's down at the earth is because the female energy represents the Mother Earth. And so that's why Malkut is at the bottom. And I think it's important for us to realize that when we exclude women, historically, like we have, it's just created so much suffering. It's unbelievable.
Yes.
And men lose out from it as well.
Yeah,
because,
yeah.
You know, men are kind of forced into roles, you know, or have been historically forced into roles, you know, where they have to kind of declare their masculinity and you know, they have to play up to that part, which doesn't come naturally to all men. You know, we need that balance in ourselves too. So not having that side, not being taught to respect your mother is, you know, it's psychologically not good for men as well.
But I mean,
also women have lost out mostly by this, but I'm not saying
well yes, but I mean, when you consider just something practical, like just how much has been lost over the millennia from not educating women properly and giving them a chance to stand with men, right. You know, on various projects. You know, you could have had, you know, engineers in ancient Egypt, for example, working, I mean, you might have done actually, we don't know, in Egypt. But I mean, elsewhere, you know, you could have had female engineers working with the men. Had a culture accepted women as relatable, equal intellectually to men and equal spiritually to men, just right. Think how much talent has been lost over the millennia.
Well, recently, remember that there's been an expose about NASA, you know, that had women doing the calculations.
Yes.
But it was hidden, it was secret. Yeah. Now finally it came out.
We saw the movie, we know. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So yeah. I really want you to talk about how Jesus respected the divine feminine and also Simon Magus and then opposed to Peter. So your book has a lot of information about the truth of of Jesus' mission here,
which
really had a lot to do with Mary Magdalene.
It did. I mean, one of the things that we really found while we were doing the research for this book that kind of brought everything together was this figure, the figure of Sophia, female wisdom. That was quite put together in Jewish philosophical circles in the centuries just leading up to Jesus' time, and this figure of Sophia really does bring everything together, because on the one hand, when we looked at it, she's the continuation of Asherah, who had by that time been taken out of the religion. But also, it's something that a lot of scholars have now realized, is that Jesus, as portrayed in the Gospels, when he teaches, he's presenting himself as the messenger of Sophia, of female wisdom, specifically female wisdom, to the point that again, this is academics, not kind of, you know, people of a kind of new age persuasion, actually call Jesus Sophia now, because that him being the messenger of Sophia was so important to him. And a lot of that's been disguised by the translation. Well, they've disguised it in two ways. In some gospels where Jesus says, delivers a message on behalf of the wisdom of God, as he puts it, the wisdom of God says, in later Gospels, the same thing has been changed to "I say," you know, so it's put in Jesus' mouth, not him as messenger of the wisdom of God. And then the other thing that's happened, certainly in the King James Version, is that wisdom of God, which is a force, you know, a female force, it's been translated as God in his wisdom decided to do this. So that's the understanding the real role of Sophia in Jesus' teaching is really important, but then it's linked.
Somehow I lost you. Somehow we have.
And right.
Well, I just lost you for a minute, by the way. And it froze again just now. I don't know if you can hear me, but right now I can't hear anything and I don't see any movement on your side. So we can edit this, so it's not a problem. And it's freezing.
Back.
Yeah. Can you hear us?
Now I can.
You'd gone. Sorry, yeah. I don't know what happened there.
I don't know what happened. Yeah.
Yes,
Mary Magdalene.
Yes, you were about to say something on about Mary Magdalene.
Yeah. Right. Well, I just want the audience to know that we're picking up after we lost you, so they'll understand the break. Jesus had picked Mary, or they found each other, so that Jesus could support the reestablishment of the divine feminine.
Yes, essentially, we in this book and in our previous book, Masks of Christ, we pieced together what Jesus' mission was, and it was quite difficult to do, but essentially it seems he was trying to restore the ancient Israelite religion, which had the sacred feminine, had gods and goddesses, plural. So in doing that, he really had to have, by his side, he had to have a representative of the sacred feminine, and we all know who that was. Thanks to not just the biblical gospels, but the so-called Gnostic gospels, the ones that most people vaguely heard of now, thanks to the Da Vinci Code and so on, but gospels such as the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Thomas, which were hidden for nearly two millennia and found again in the mid-20th century. And they paint a very clear picture of Jesus and Mary's relationship, which was spiritually equal. He was quite clearly personally besotted with her, and they were in a physical relationship. And she was pretty much she was his priestess. She acted like one. She actually, even in the New Testament, it describes her doing the most incredible thing. Because, as we know, Christ simply means anointed one, and there's only one anointing in the New Testament, and it's told in a very garbled way, probably deliberately. But it was a woman, and in the context, although she's not named, it's quite clearly Mary Magdalene, who uses the perfumed ointment to anoint Jesus. And she clearly understood. I mean, it was a ritual that was agreed between both of them. So she christened him. She picked him out and anointed him for his fate, for his destiny. And you don't get much more power than doing that. And she was obviously invested with that power. So she was certainly acting as a priestess. And she was, we believe, continuing or trying to continue the priestesship of Asherah.
And she carried it actually into southern France later on.
Yes, I know. Yes, we've been to all the places associated.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah.
The Cathars weren't treated well in the end, she really created a big following in southern France. So, and then there's also Helen, who, because her associate Simon Magus is—he was a New Age guy.
Well, that's one way of putting it, actually.
So he brought her in.
And somebody else who was certainly trying to restore the sacred feminine into—he was a Samaritan, so it was into the Samaritan version of Judaism, if you like. Obviously gets a bit confused with Judaism meaning tribe of Judah and Samaritans being slightly different. So actually we talk about the original religion of the Israelites or the Hebrews or of Moses. And as most people know about Simon Magus, you know, he worked in partnership with this woman, Helen, who was, he said, was a former prostitute that he had found, purchased her freedom, and by doing so, and making her the center of his teaching, was bringing about salvation of humankind.
Right.
And the more we looked at that as we're writing the book, we actually realized what a kind of a really modern metaphor this is, or a modern statement, because what Simon Magus was really saying is women have been demeaned, and looked down upon. If we treat women with complete respect, including acknowledging their sexuality, which was a big part of what he was teaching, but if we elevate these women, this will bring the salvation of all of us. This will help both women and men. And we're actually thinking that is so modern.
Exactly. We're getting to the end of the show, and I want to make sure people know how to find you. And your book is When God Had a Wife.
Mm-hmm.
You are Lynn Picknett, P-I-C-K-N-E-T-T, and Clive Prince, C-L-I-V-E. What is a website for you?
We have a website, picknettprince.com. So if you just Google us, you can find us there. And you can get the book through there, but also from Amazon or from, right, you know, all the usual places.
Sure. Yeah, this is great, and we could have talked for hours because
so
much. And maybe we can talk again.
That would be lovely. Like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good.
There's so much about this to say.
Yeah.
I know, and you guys have really done so much work. Plus, you have many other books behind you that are fascinating, and I want to be able to read some of them because I'm excited about the subject matters. So I really want to thank you for being on Energy Stew. This is terrific.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Peter.
It's been fun.
And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org. I'd love to hear from you, and thanks so much for listening.